Next up on This Week in Law, Natalie Nichols joins Matt Curtis, Mike Keyes, and me. I'm Denise Howell. We'll discuss what can, is, or should be on a Louis Vuitton bag. We'll talk about some fashion industry IP issues like 3D printing and counterfeiting. Tupac may be dead, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't license his image. And we're seeing yellow dots. All this and more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis. Episode 389, recorded June 9th, 2017. I want a biobot! This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Betterment, the largest independent online financial advisor. For one low, transparent fee, Betterment gives you personalized advice and invests your money. For a limited time, you can get up to 6 months managed for free. Learn more at betterment.com/TWiL. Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. Hey, thanks so much for joining us for This Week in Law. We've got an amazing show for you this week. We've just been going through all the topics. We're excited to bring them all to you. And I am excited to bring you our wonderful panel of folks to help understand these cutting edge issues at the intersection of technology and law. We've got a great guest today. Her name is Natalie Nichol. She is legal counsel for sunglass and eyeglass brand DITA, D-I-T-A. If you've gone to your optometrist lately, you may have seen their really wonderful eyeglass frames. I definitely have DITA envy, Natalie. She advises her company on e-commerce issues, digital marketing, brand protection, and privacy. And while she was in law school, she worked at the Berkman Center at Harvard. She worked at the EFF. She worked at the First Amendment Project. And currently, right now, still works with our friend Colette Vogel at the Without My Consent nonprofit. We've talked about that on the show before, but in case you missed it, it targets revenge porn and other invasions of privacy. So really great to have you on the show, Natalie.
Thank you so much for having me, Denise.
Also here this week is my co-host, Matt Curtis. Hi, Matt. Great to see you again.
Hi, thanks for having me on again. Recording here from Michigan, and it's great to be home and it's great to be on the show.
We've got all kinds of great things to discuss today. One thing that Natalie pays a lot of attention to and that we love discussing on the show is the intellectual property intersection with the world of fashion. So we're going to start out talking about some copyright issues. We have some really interesting stories to talk about at the intersection of fashion and law. And I do think that it ties in with the online world, too, because the way in which things are sold these days tend to be very much via the internet and other e-commerce mechanisms. So I think it all kind of ties together. First of all, earlier this year, we talked a lot about a case just to set the stage for some of our additional discussion here today from the Supreme Court that changes things for the fashion industry. We're not quite sure how it will change things. But maybe some of our cases that we're going to highlight today will help us understand that. The case, it was called Varsity Brands versus Star Athletica. We talked about it a lot at the time that it came out. We're not going to go into it in too much detail here, but just remind you that it happened and that the way in which it sort of alters the way that the fashion industry thinks about copyright is it allowed for certain elements of a fashion design to be copyrighted that were sort of in a gray area before. And I think there are gray areas that continue to exist afterwards. But this was the case that involved the cheerleading uniforms and the stripes and chevrons and the ways that they impacted the design of the uniform itself. And so the fashion industry has come away from that case going, well, it's exciting for us because we have some ground to protect ourselves that we didn't have before. And in fact, Vogue magazine, in writing this up, characterizes it as follows. The impact of this decision could have on high fashion is great. Not only does it provide luxury houses with some ground to defend themselves against fast fashion retailers who churn out replicas of runway designs before the originals hit the stores, but it also has the potential to discourage designers from borrowing motifs from their peers or from the past. Designers have relied mostly on trademarks to protect themselves, but now they can argue that more conceptual, less obvious aspects of their designs should be protected by copyright too. So Vogue doesn't try to tell you what less obvious, more conceptual parts of the design are going to be found by courts to be subject to copyright, like the elements in Star Athletica. And that's where things get a bit murky. But what we do know in the wake of the case is there is some degree of copyright protection that wasn't there before. Natalie, anything you want to add to this discussion?
Yeah, you know, before we dive in, I do just want to give the normal disclaimer that I'm not speaking on behalf of my employer, and any views that I give here are purely personal, and that I'm not speaking on behalf of my company. You know, I'm happy to weigh in from, you know, a fashion industry lawyer's perspective. You know, I think this is a really important case. And like you said, it's going to take some time to see how it really plays out. I don't know how much this is really going to do to curb fast fashion retailers who to this point have been extremely brazen in duplicating, you know, luxury fashion houses' design. So it remains to be seen whether or not it's really going to curb the fast fashion industry in a meaningful way. I think that, you know, one thing that we'll definitely start to see is more and more fashion houses, you know, moving quickly to register these two and three dimensional elements of their unique designs with the Copyright Office. And I think copyright does offer brands some advantages that design patents and trademarks, you know, don't. And one of those things is the speed at which you can register them and the costs associated with doing so. So this could be a major advantage, you know, to fashion brands. At the same time, it could make it more difficult and, you know, more burdensome for designers to try to figure out what is and isn't infringing as they're coming up with designs. And, you know, as we all know, the bar for originality is you know, fairly low. And this could create kind of a thicket that designers will have to keep in mind as they, you know, move from, you know, the design phase towards bringing things to the market.
Matt, anything, you know, it's been a couple of months since Star Athletica was decided. I don't think there's been really probably enough time to see its long-term impact yet, but just any thoughts that our discussion of that case has raised that you want to get out on the table?
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to watch it 20 years down the line when fashions kind of recycle, how that's affected. But I haven't seen any data points that I've been watching that have tipped the scale of how that's going to go.
Right. Well, I think that's the perfect segue into this next story, which is a partnership that has been recently announced and debuted between artist Jeff Koons and, you know, huge handbag brand Louis Vuitton. They're doing a line called the Masters Collection, which is, you know, depending on your perspective, really great or really awful. It takes, as you can see if you're watching the video, Masters paintings by such people as Leonardo da Vinci, and puts them on handbags and various other leather goods that Louis Vuitton manufactures, along with the Louis Vuitton branding and logos and things. The bunny is new to me. I'm seeing bunnies on all the Louis Vuitton stuff in this story. And I don't know when they added in a bunny as part of their branding.
I think that's actually a nod to some of Jeff Koons' iconic balloon sculpture.
It's supposed to be the balloon sculpture thing. Yeah. That would be, because I was having the hardest time, figuring out, okay, so it's Masters art and Louis Vuitton logos and leather. And how does Jeff Koons come into this? It's that would be it. Yes. Okay. So it's not a bunny. It's whatever the balloon animal creature that Jeff Koons is famous for is. It could be a bunny, but now it makes sense. Thank you, Natalie. So it's a very interesting remix, obviously, of classical art and, you know, they've seen fit to put on each work the particular artist that they're the name of the particular artist that they're featuring in a particular font, and they're selling it for between, I think the pricing I saw on them were in the high hundreds, $700 or so, to up about $4,000 or so for the pieces that we're looking at here, which is actually fairly inexpensively priced for Louis Vuitton. If you've ever gone and priced to their things, you could spend a lot more than $4,000 if you were so inclined. So really interesting IP overlay to this whole thing. We've got the partnership between Koons and Louis Vuitton, and obviously whatever they're doing is licensed and partnered up with one another. But then we're bringing in these masters paintings and using not just the paintings themselves, but also the name of the artist, all of which, because they are so old, is in the public domain at this point. But there might be various people who will surface and say that perhaps they have some sort of interest in what's going on here. I don't think that that's happened, but it's certainly possible. And I think it goes right to what Matt was saying a moment ago, as far as elements that you can copyright and not copyright. Certainly Koons and Vuitton are going to say that if you create a bag that is close enough to what they've done here, that you're infringing on their copyright and various aspects of the designs here. So I think it's fascinating and sort of a good footnote to the Star Athletica case. What do you think, Natalie?
Well, I think this is a really imaginative use of public domain works. And I think it's a super fun celebration of the importance in, you know, these types of classical works, even in modern fashion. So I'm personally a huge fan of the collaboration. I think it's really clever and fun. I do think, you know, as some commentators have pointed out, that it is kind of ripe for IP overreach. And it's going to be interesting to see whether they wade into the waters of kind of trying to, you know, control imitations of these bags, given the fact that the artistic works that have been applied to the handbags and scarves and other, you know, items of apparel and accessories are very clearly in the public domain. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. I kind of also love that Jeff Koons is involved in this. As most, you know, many people know, he's been a frequent defendant in copyright infringement lawsuits. So it's he's frequently been sued for copyright infringement himself. So his use of copyrighted works has been interesting and controversial throughout his career.
Mm-hmm. Right, and it will be interesting if they decide to get aggressive about people making their own handbags and other leather goods that have masters on them, which you know, as far as I'm concerned, as long as they don't have the funny balloon bunny attached and the various other logos, maybe having the name of the artist plastered across would be difficult, particularly if it's in a similar font as what they've used here. But one of the critiques of this from people who think that, you know, our culture is going to hell literally in a handbag is that this is not, you know, worthy of the Louis Vuitton brand, that they've decided to go sort of flea market chic with this. But to the extent they're right, I'm with you, Natalie, I like it. I mean, I kind of think they're appealing and fun, and it'd be fun to carry one of these around if you wanted to drop that much money on one. But and also that, you know, it's sort of fun to have wearable art. And I think they're not going to be able to stop people from doing similar things unless they're clearly trying to capitalize on the Louis Vuitton and Jeff Koons elements that are present here. Do you agree, Mike?
I do. I actually love this collaboration. I think it is a very fun way to reconstitute old great works and kind of bring them to the masses in a new, creative, fun way. Mm-hmm. There are lots of IP interesting IP issues here, as you noted. The copyright angle is obviously has overtones of the Star Athletica case. Of course, you can't claim copyright protection in somebody else's work, certainly these great masters' works. But to the extent that you have added additional elements or additional aspects to those works, you could claim copyright protection in those additional elements that you have added. But the copyright protection that you have or that Louis Vuitton would have wouldn't extend to include the prior works of these great masters. So that would be off the table. But it does also raise interesting issues about trademark rights. So even though Da Vinci, for example, is the painter of the famous Mona Lisa, and Da Vinci is the name of an artist, there could be potentially some trademark rights associated with a brand, the Da Vinci brand that they would be launching here, for example. There's potential trademark rights associated with that. And of course, their unique look and feel of this particular handbag or these series of handbags could be subject to trade dress protection as well. So there are lots of interesting IP angles here, lots of potential ways that these bags could be protected. But by and large, to the extent that Louis Vuitton and or Jeff Koons would want to try to stop another third-party competitor from using these great works on handbags, that is probably not going to get very far.
Yeah, that's not their strongest angle, certainly.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
And one thing we should just mention is in some of the coverage of this, it has come up that Jeff Koons himself has a pretty extensive art collection with some of these masters' paintings in it, but that certainly wouldn't help him at all from a copyright standpoint, and is just something that I think people might at first blush think could be helpful, but it's not under, at least not under U.S. copyright. If you own a work, this does not then entitle you to copy that work and put it on a handbag and sell it commercially, right, Mike?
That's exactly right. So our copyright laws draw a very clear line of distinction between ownership of the underlying work and the copyright associated with that work.
Mm-hmm. And he certainly doesn't own the Mona Lisa.
Right. I would not think so.
No. Matt,
the Louvre in Paris, I think, would have some pretty harsh words for him.
That's right. Matt, what do you think of all this? Are you going to go out and buy a Fragonard wallet?
You caught me. That was the first thing I was going to do. No, I think that my knowledge of fashion in general is a net negative. But I am surprised that something like this hasn't popped up on Etsy or something before. I didn't have time to look if that angle had come. The similar analysis to bringing a claim against Louis Vuitton for copying that.
I think that's a really good point, actually, Matt, that that probably people have been putting classical paintings, public domain art on things like this for a while, whether they're tote bags or something more high-end leather like what Louis Vuitton makes. And to the extent that they have, and they now see this, what promises to be a very lucrative partnership between Jeff Koons and Louis Vuitton. Do you, Natalie, do you expect to see people come out of the woodwork and say, we thought of this first and you're too close to our works?
I don't know. I think it's hard to go up against major players. I mean, between Jeff Koons and Louis Vuitton, there's, these are huge players, both in the art world and the fashion world. So I'd be very surprised to see anyone kind of come out of the woodwork and try to take aim at them. But you never know. And I do think that this collaboration and others like it is kind of indicative of a larger trend we're seeing in the fashion industry. I'm starting to see more and more high-end brands want to collaborate with emerging brands. And it's kind of, in my opinion, a golden age of the collaboration in the fashion industry. So I'm more excited to just see what's coming next and who thinks of the next clever collaboration like this.
Yeah, me too. And it is, you know, it's not universally accepted as this is a great thing for art or culture. One of the critiques, and we've linked to all the stories that we've looked at to get ready for the show here. You can look at them too if you go to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. We're on episode 389. So one of the pieces that we've linked to there talks about how, and this is from their piece, on the one hand, Vuitton is exploiting art for its own gain. On the other, an artist is selling out. In the middle, consumers are being introduced to great art as if it is disposable. In part to counter this, Vuitton and Kunz have added a sub-narrative to the project that spins it as an effort to address the failing profile of classical art, a civic service, if you will. Inside each bag, for example, is a little description of the artist, like a hidden history lesson for the Twitter generation. what do you think, Natalie? Is that good or bad?
I think they're taking this way too seriously. I think this is fun and it's an interesting and exciting way to celebrate art. You know, taste is subjective, and I think some of this criticism is a little unwarranted. So
right. It is pretty interesting just from, you know, how do you take a really established brand like Louis Vuitton and keep it new and relevant, and the intellectual property issues around all that. One other thing that caught my eye in just putting together links about this master's project is another partnership they did earlier this year with a company called Supreme that I hadn't heard of before, but it's sort of a skate brand that had been, you know, sort of cult and indie and on its own. But they partnered up with Louis Vuitton to do a whole bunch of, you know, from my perspective, I think this stuff is really fun and cool as well. A lot of the Louis Vuitton branding incorporated too. But then, you know, things like shoulder bags and fanny bags and things that you might, folios and things that you would expect to see some young urban professional, God, are those still a thing? Running around in New York or San Francisco wearing this stuff and thinking they were kind of all that. But at jean jackets and things too. But again, you know, this is not, there's no real IP issue triggered here of the brand appropriating anything without permission, because it is partnered up with Supreme. And again, Supreme was criticized for selling out, but you know, hey, they're making money and Louis Vuitton is making money and people are looking stylish. So I really can't find too much fault with it. What do you think, Natalie?
You know, like I said, I think this has just been a really like excellent time in the industry to see these types of exciting collaborations. Supreme is definitely having a moment. They are enjoying wild success. And I recently read some coverage that as they're releasing their new, you know, apparel and accessories, it's selling out in unprecedented time, and that, you know, some of their items, their t-shirts that sell, you know, maybe for $100 max are fetching, you know, 4 and 5 times that on eBay. They are wildly, wildly popular.
Right. So given all that wild popularity of, you know, what we assume will happen with the Masters collection and also with this Supreme collection, we alluded to the fact that people other than those who are participating in these projects may attempt to profit from them. And of course, you know, Louis Vuitton has got to be one of the most knocked off brands on the planet, because they've been around, as I mentioned, for such a long time, and they're just kind of iconic. And I think we're at a really interesting time where, of course, there's already been a ton of counterfeiting of their brand and others, but now we're entering this age where the counterfeiting is aided by technology, and specifically 3D printing. And so you don't necessarily have to have a huge fashion factory to be able to crank these things out. Just a sufficiently enabled 3D printer and access to the designs to make something that looks pretty close to the original. And even if it doesn't look that close to the original, people might not care. You know, it's close enough and less money. And some people might feel like that would be fine for them to buy such a thing. From your perspective as counsel to a fashion brand, and particularly one that makes something that could be 3D printed, Natalie, what do you think of this development?
Yeah, I think that this is just another technological development that brands are going to have to deal with. And I think many, you know, designers, especially in the apparel or in the accessories business, so jewelry, watches, sunglasses, they're already utilizing 3D printing to aid them in the design and development process. This is, you know, yet another example of a double-edged sword. On the other side, you know, this means that people can, you know, with access to this technology, which is becoming less and less expensive, can produce, you know, counterfeits that are so close to the original and, you know, adopt, you know, all of the unique design features. So I think this is going to be yet another challenge that brands have to confront. And, you know, from my perspective, you know, this counterfeiting is something that every luxury brand and every popular brand is going to have to deal with. And, you know, brands are going to have to, you know, adapt their brand protection strategy in light of these new technological developments. It's unavoidable. It's where things are headed. So,
right. And it's a recurring theme on our show that, you know, as one industry or technology comes along that can disrupt and make it easier to knock something off or have access to something, that then there's this sort of cat and mouse elevation of, you know, how you fight back. And the way some fashion brands are fighting back is, for example, Vivienne Westwood and Moncler have started to apply RFID chips to their products. The chips contain a unique ID that will allow consumers to scan and authenticate their goods via their smartphones or on the fashion brand's websites. So, you know, if you didn't think it was bad enough that you're running around with location tracking in your phone and in your fast track device in your car, it's quite possible that right down to your clothing or your wallet or anything else that, you know, a brand might be concerned could be copyrighted. You might have RFID chips that are just there as a DRM measure that could be repurposed and used for more nefarious purposes as well. Mike, what do you think of this?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting development. You know, I'm curious, Natalie, on your thoughts as to the effectiveness of such a program using RFID chips, because, I mean, wouldn't that require quite a bit of education of the consumers to get the consumers on board that they even need to be scanning their particular products to make sure they're genuine? And I think part of the big problem with counterfeit goods is that, you know, there's such high demand for it because consumers want it. You know, they'd like, I guess, for various reasons to be able to get the item cheaper. You know, maybe they feel like they're getting a deal as a result of having a cheaper product. Of course, they are getting a better deal. There's all sorts of downsides to it, of course. So I don't know. It seems to me like you've got a pretty significant consumer education issue to deal with before RFID and other stuff's really going to be very effective at battling counterfeits.
Yeah, I think you've seen, you know, over time, even before the advent of this type of technology, brands trying to educate customers on how to spot genuine products. I think many luxury websites, including, you know, I've seen Tiffany has, you know, a section on their website about how to spot genuine products. And many brands, you know, have already tried to kind of take a consumer education angle, you know, as part of their overall branding efforts. And I think these types of programs that are aimed at consumers, you know, to consumers who are spending, you know, a lot of money on genuine products, you know, it's understandable that they'd want to verify the authenticity of their product. And, you know, from a luxury brand's perspective, it's probably great that RFID chips and RFID technology could be used in this way as a kind of digital certificate of authenticity.
Is there a way, though, do you think, Natalie, to first something like Vivienne Westwood or Moncler to assure their customers, we're putting this on to make sure that you have our legitimate item, but we also care about your privacy and we've, you know, used the best technology we can to make sure that this is only going to be used for that purpose?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, a conscientious brand would certainly take into consideration, you know, these types of privacy concerns. And as far as I know, I think RFID has been used in many retail stores. And even on the lower end, I think retailers are using RFID technology for theft and inventory control. You know, so I think this technology is already widely in use. They're just using it in kind of this different, unique way, you know, to verify the authenticity of the product. So I think RFID has been in use by brands for a long time.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I don't know how many people realize when they get a new item of clothing home and they're hanging it up that they should take the time and a pair of scissors and cut out those RFID tags. And they're actually labeled that way. They have a little dotted line and instructions that you're supposed to cut it off after purchase. But I just don't know, you know, how many people realize that that's the case and that if they don't do it, they're running around with RFID tags in their clothing. Matt, are you cutting off your tags?
I didn't even, I'm pretty sure the stores I shop at don't have those.
You're keeping them all in that Fragonard wallet.
Correct.
You'd be surprised.
Whatever that word means. My thought, though, is that RFID technology for this use is just like impractical because RFID technology requires an RFID scanner. And so in stores, it makes sense because you're able to monitor a massive system. But if you're checking like individually, if your product is real, NFC or near field communication makes a lot more sense. I'm not sure if Apple has allowed developers to use it yet. It's a couple of years since I looked at it. But most Android phones are unlocked to use their NFC, and therefore that could be valuable. But from my understanding, RFID would require a separate system which you had to attach to your phone. I can't imagine too many people wanting to do it anyways. I certainly can't imagine people buying a product in order to test for the RFID, maybe send it in or something. But I'm not their prime consumer either.
All right. Well, I think our first MCLE passphrase for the show will be check your tags and cut them off too, if you haven't noticed that they're there. We put these phrases in the show in case you're a lawyer or other professional who likes to watch or listen to our show for professional credit in your field. Some places, some jurisdictions that do oversight on that need to know that you've watched or listened, need to have some way that you demonstrate that. So we put these phrases in the show, jot them down, and if you know them at the end, then you can verify, yes, I really watched and listened to the whole show. As we are discussing counterfeit merchandise, let's discuss it in the context of the sports and entertainment realm and how entertainment law issues might be impacted. So, of course, the NBA finals are going on right now. Lots of excitement about all that. And one thing that folks who are paying attention to such things have noticed is that when you have a big sporting event like this, Super Bowl, NBA finals, World Series, what have you, you're going to see an uptick in the availability of counterfeit goods involving the teams who are playing so that fans can support them. And there's a really interesting post at the Fashion Law blog about this and about how they do see these spikes. And the spikes are noticed by the U.S. customs agencies who are charged with intercepting these items as they are coming and going across borders. Some really interesting stats there about what they've been able to learn about things attempting to cross borders. In 2016 alone, the U.S. government seized $1.38 billion worth of counterfeit goods across various industries. The counterfeit trade as a whole, however, was valued at more than $460 billion and growing in 2013, making the number of seizures rather small in comparison. Going to your point, Mike, that people tend to not care so much if things are counterfeited. You know, if you're if you're a sports fan going to your team's game and you want to support your team, it's going to be, I think, less important to you that the Warriors jersey that you paid a little bit less for is not authentic, because you're still accomplishing your goal, right? You're there and you're supporting your team and you saved a few bucks in the process. But one of the things that the Department of Homeland Security points out is that consumers who tend to have this view may not realize that these counterfeiting efforts have consistently been tied to international crime rings that use the practice to launder money from illegal drug sales and human trafficking, and thus making it not a victimless crime. So you might want to think about that in the way that you support your sports team. And the other really interesting aspect of this is because things are arriving more and getting intercepted more, not, you know, physically coming across the border in somebody's suitcase or, you know, otherwise being intercepted in an airport or via air freight that way, but via express courier and international mail. And that's because fakes are increasingly being bought largely at Amazon and eBay and shipped directly to people's homes in individual packages. So the whole ability to forego going down to Canal Street or whatever, just log on to eBay, find whatever it is you're looking for, and it gets shipped straight to your home. So both an ease of access to these kinds of goods that maybe we didn't see traditionally and a challenge in intercepting the way that they come in and then get resold, or maybe they don't even come into the U.S. There's no need that, you know, when you're buying on Amazon or eBay that you be purchasing from someone within U.S. borders either. So, Natalie, what do you make of all this?
You know, I think this is just, you know, another example of the kind of cat and mouse or whack-a-mole, you know, game of brand protection that, you know, brands, including sports teams, you know, is kind of forced to play. And, you know, it is easier. Like you said, you know, people no longer have to go down to Canal Street or to the back of, you know, the sports stadium, you know, during a playoff game to kind of try to find these imitations or counterfeit, you know, jerseys or merchandise. And so it's just easier now than ever for people who, you know, don't mind if the product is not genuine to log online and to buy it. And you know, the customs agencies can only do so much. They're only going to intercept, you know, a small portion of shipments that are coming, you know, from within the United States and across borders. And, you know, they can only do so much. So, you know, we're always going to see these types of shocking statistics come from Customs and Border Protection. They release these, you know, annually and, you know, come out with these, you know, massive figures about the counterfeit industry. And, you know, this is just nothing new. It's kind of par for the course of being in this industry.
And Mike, of course, over the years, Amazon and eBay have been hit with various complaints by legitimate manufacturers about knockoff goods available on their platforms. But it seems like it would be really hard for them to police.
It's fiendishly hard for them to police. And from a trademark perspective, which by and large, most of these types of cases are, you know, the law is kind of on the online retailer side, because as a trademark owner, if you try to pursue a third party online marketplace such as an eBay or Amazon, you know, you're going to have to take steps to show that they knew that there was infringement going on, or they suspected it and they failed to take action to do it. And these online retailers are so large and so pervasive, it's difficult just from a pure man hours perspective for them to be able to monitor their marketplace with any degree of sufficient oversight to help eradicate the problem. So it's a very complicated issue on, I guess, from a legal perspective. But then, you know, to a large extent, this is also, and I'm not saying that this is, you know, an easy solution, because it's not, but it's to a certain extent, a large extent, it's an economic issue. I mean, there's economic incentives for counterfeiters to continue to counterfeit. And that's because they're able to offer their goods at a significantly reduced rate versus the licensed goods. So there's such a disparity in price, there's going to be market demand for that. So I think that also needs to be addressed too.
It's not a perfect analogy because we're talking about in the copyright realm, perfect copies of digital goods versus imperfect copies of real world goods with counterfeiting. But it does seem like there should be some sort of parallel legal approach to how YouTube has to deal with unauthorized uploads of infringing material. It does seem like there should be some sort of DMCA-like process that would give online retailers some cover and yet allow brand owners who are concerned about counterfeits to give notice and have something taken down, or have someone then be able to challenge that and say, no, actually, this should stay up for the following legal reasons. Have you, Mike, seen any movement toward that kind of an approach?
Yes, as a matter of fact, as you may recall, when we had Marty Schwimmer on the show a while back, mm-hmm. he was talking about his TMR article where he articulated a DMCA takedown process for trademark related products. So
that's right. Yeah.
I think there's a lot of, it makes a lot of sense. I think there's some practical problems associated with it. But no, I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, I will say though, that a lot of online retailers, Amazon and eBay, I think being, two of them, you know, they will, you know, they don't treat necessarily the trademark notices in the same way that they treat DMCA notices, for example. But, you know, I think they do by and large try to police their marketplace to the extent they can. But part of the problem here is that you're putting the online retailers in the position of having to judge, well, is this particular individual or company that's approaching me, do they have the rights that they claim they have? And how am I supposed to determine who's got superior rights? So it's a very difficult process to have to deal with.
Right. Matt, any thoughts on these counterfeiting and trademark issues before we move on?
I think the DMCA for the trademark is an interesting idea. I do agree with Mike that this is largely a matter of market forces. When these companies are going to capture the highest value of items, you know, they're trying to get $150 or $300 for a jersey that costs $20 to make. They know that this is going to create a demand for fraudulently made and sold goods. They're choosing not to capture the lower value market for a reason. So I don't think it's right that people are selling fakes or anything like that. And I think that we should do everything to stop it. But I would suspect that this is built into the business model.
Yeah, you would think so. One thing that you would also think would be built into someone's business model if they're someone like Forever 21 or Urban Outfitters, huge retail clothing stores, is that if you were going to sell a shirt with the image of Tupac on it, that you would be sure that you had gotten the proper licensing in order to be able to use that image. Unfortunately, that's not what happened here. Forever 21 and Urban Outfitters were selling the shirt that you're looking at if you're watching our video. And the photographer who took the picture of Tupac Shakur surfaced and said, hey, nobody came to me. I'm not getting paid. You do not have permission to use my photo. WTF. So is suing and probably will, you know, it remains to be seen what will be argued in the case, but he's asking for at least $600,000 in damages plus attorney's fees and the recall and destruction of any remaining inventory of the shirts. What do you think, Natalie? What would you expect to hear Urban Outfitters or Forever 21 saying in defense of this?
you know, I'm not sure the practical matter that this will make it to court. You know, I think these types of things typically settle. And so I'm not sure that we'll have, you know, the ability to see really how this plays out, you know, out in the open. I don't think that they would have a really strong claim for fair use here. I mean, this is an obvious commercial use of these types of images. And then in addition to the issues that you're dealing with the photographer, you know, I did a quick search of registrations, you know, trademark registrations for Tupac, and there are several active registrations, including in class 25 for apparel. So, you know, you have some right of publicity issues here too, when you're using a celebrity's name and likeness. The likeness is on the front in this case, and his name is on the back. So right. They've got some other issues here with, you know, producing these types of garments in an unauthorized manner.
Right. Yeah. I, you know, at first blush, just reading this, I would think that they'd have to roll over and settle and probably wouldn't have much of a basis for fighting the lawsuit. But Mike, can you think of any way that this could be a fair use?
Boy, I'd have to stretch to make this a fair use case.
Yeah.
I think I agree with Natalie completely. I don't see a fair use here. It's probably one of those situations where Forever 21 and Urban Outfitters thought that they had the rights because maybe a third party, you know, gave them a license to it. And they thought they were doing what they could be doing under the license, but in fact didn't. It sounds like, at least from the, I haven't read the complaint, but based on the news accounts that I read, it sounds like it was more of a licensing related dispute and a misunderstanding as to who had proper rights to grant. But the other issues that Natalie raised, that, you know, the registrations for Tupac, I mean, there could be a potential trademark infringement claim associated with the use of the name. And as people probably know, even though Tupac, I think he was killed probably close to 20 years or so ago now. Publicity rights, depending on the state, I think most states have publicity rights that that survive after death. So his heirs could potentially have a claim for violation of the right of publicity.
Right.
Yeah, his estate was most recently managed by his mother, who recently passed away. It's now in the hands of one of his former record executives. You know, we have postmortem publicity rights in California, and the New York State Legislature has often tried to pass, you know, a statute that would give postmortem publicity rights. So, you know, I know that there are record executives and people with a strong financial interest in commercializing his name and likeness still to this day who would take issue with this type of thing.
So I'm looking on eBay to see what you can find in the way of Tupac jerseys there. And there are several. So to the extent that those trademark owners, I'm seeing that mostly they're using the image and not the name. But I think one would go really well with a Fragonard wallet, Matt.
We're gonna I'll look into it. I'll look into it
before this. Oh, we've got a $250 post-game Tupac Shakur above the rim birdie hockey camo jersey.
Sounds subtle.
Just what I've been looking for.
Right. A post-game would only matter if it had been worn by a hockey player, right? Well, I don't know why you're putting that in the title. Are you saying that it was worn by a hockey player? I think that would be a difficult thing to wear to a game. Anyway. The wonderful, wide, wacky world of trademark counterfeiting and availability and then infringement of dead celebrities' images. We've been talking a lot about the right way and the wrong way to put together something to sell to the public. But let's talk for a little bit about, you know, once you've made your item, whether you've crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's in getting your licensing together or not, how do you sell it? One way that people do it increasingly these days is with brand ambassadors, cue Fyre Festival theme music. So we wanted to discuss that a bit with Natalie today as well. Involving, of course, the social web, because that's how brand ambassadors get their word out. So again, at the Fashion Law blog, there's a good piece there speculating and analyzing what brand ambassadors are really paid to do. And, you know, as near as I can tell, what they do is not pay a whole lot of attention to how they're supposed to disclose their brand ambassador relationship, because they certainly have been getting themselves in hot water on that issue. But beyond that, maybe paying closer attention to the legal requirements on them, all they really have to do is sashay around looking pouty or beautiful, displaying the brand in question. Natalie, is it any more complicated than that?
Well, I think, you know, as I'm sure many attorneys and people in, you know, this field are aware, the FTC kind of recently showed some renewed interest in influencer marketers and proper disclosures when it comes to disclosing material affiliations between a brand and an influencer or celebrity who's wearing your products. So just recently, the FTC issued 90 letters. They were just actually obtained by an organization through a Freedom of Information Act request. And so people were able to see who received this letter, these letters. It was a combination of both high-end fashion brands, some kind of lifestyle products, and celebrities who kind of got a warning notice from the FTC about proper disclosure. And up until this point, the FTC hadn't necessarily been clear on exactly what qualified and didn't qualify as a proper disclosure, especially with respect to social media posts. And so they made some, more clear guidance on what does and doesn't qualify for proper disclosure. They got really specific and said that, if you're an influencer who's been, given product with an expectation that you're going to post it, not only, do you have to really clearly use a hashtag like advertisement or hashtag sponsored, but it has to be above the, on Instagram at least, above the point at which your comments would be collapsed. And so this is as clear as the FTC has ever been on this issue.
Right. And I'm kind of coming down on these people for not, and their representatives, for not having enough awareness of what they're required to do by the FTC. But as I think about it today and read through this Fashion Law blog post, I'm realizing that it's more complicated than you might think, because the FTC doesn't seem to have any problem with non-disclosure of an influencer relationship and contract with a brand if all you're doing is wandering around in the world displaying that brand, over your shoulder as a handbag or as a logo on whatever you're wearing, or even, not as a logo, just in a very identifiable dress that everyone knows is Gucci, for example. That if you're just being photographed in that brand, that's good for the brand, right? And that's what they're paying for. But I don't think the FTC requires you to make any disclosure when you show up somewhere looking glamorous and pouty that, this is what I'm wearing and I was paid to tell you that. They're just photographed and the brand is associated with that influencer and the brand has gotten what they wanted. And then I would think, so these photographs are out there. Oh, here's this picture of me wearing my Louis Vuitton handbag and I've retweeted it now. Now here's where I think it gets gray, because you're not, or put it on Instagram, because you're not saying, oh, don't I look cute in my Louis Vuitton bag? You're just sort of saying, here I am at this event. Then would they have to use the hashtag spawn or hashtag ad disclaimer there or disclosure there, because they're not actually in any sort of textual way promoting the brand? What do you think about that, Natalie?
Yeah, I think that this is something that both brands and their influencers are going to have to start paying more attention to. I do think that this for a layperson, for an influencer like this, it can be a little confusing about what the requirements actually are and, when they are and are not obligated to disclose. Like you said, how are you going to expect somebody, who's just on the red carpet to clearly disclose this kind of connection? And then what do you do with the images once they're generated? So this can definitely create some headaches, for brands and for the people with whom they're trying to partner.
That's right. So, Matt, with all of the goods that you're going to be showered with in the wake of the show today by these very high-end brands, I want you to be careful. I want you to be careful
about... Me and my 40 Twitter followers are going to...
That's right. Retweeting all that. What do you think? If someone just took... Well, I mean, obviously, they if they're merely resharing something online and not further commenting, I would think that they would have some comfort level that they're not running afoul of FTC guidelines. But at the same time, you know, they're promoting that brand that they're being paid by. Do you think the FTC would get upset?
They may get upset. I just think that you have really, really difficult line drawing problems. I think they're kind of similar to, you know, the right of publicity, like who has that, you know, after they're dead or whatever, you know, who can stop other people from using their name or likeness. So you have to classify people as like, you know, they are somewhat above or they have this influence. And so I guess it is if you register, if there was some sort of registry where you said you were an influencer and therefore, but just simply passing it on, I think it's really difficult.
Yeah, I think so too. Mike, do you see this getting any easier?
I'm not sure that it's going to get any easier. I agree with Natalie that there's a bit more guidance now with respect to third-party influencers and what the FTC requires, but I can't imagine we'd get to the point where celebrities running down the red carpet in their favorite whatever, you know, high-end brand are going to be required to disclose, you know, that they've got a material connection with that particular brand. That ultimately seems that seems unworkable. But
right.
There are certain groups at the Met Gala, though, that sometimes the people who walk the red carpet there, they actually just bring the designer as their date. So then it's very obvious when you're standing next to Zac Posen. It's almost the same as a hashtag sponsored on your Instagram post. So
it is. And even without the designer there, there are contexts where the commercial relationship is sort of at least implied or more on display, you know, in any sort of red carpet kind of event when the people are being stopped and gushed over and asked, you know, who are you wearing? When they say Gucci, I don't think anybody in the public thinks that they went out and paid for the gown that they're wearing or the tux.
And I think that's an argument that's repeatedly been made, you know, by people who have kind of taken issue with some of this FTC guidance is that, you know, aren't consumers becoming more and more aware of really what's going on here? And does the reasonable consumer truly think that, you know, somebody paid for their own Oscar gown out of pocket? You know, I think, you know, savvy consumers and especially people who, you know, take a keen interest in the fashion business, you know, kind of maybe you're aware of the nature of these types of, you know, influencer relationships already or have, you know, at least, you know, some working knowledge of it. So.
Right. Yeah. I think it's an evolving area and it is complicated and I'm not going to come down too hard on the people posting their vapid pictures on Instagram without the proper disclosures because making the proper disclosure is not necessarily the easiest thing in the world. But,
you know, they look great. Yeah. So it's hard to really, you know, come down too hard on them when they're looking so fabulous. So
that's true. But you would think that, you know, at least with all that looking fabulous, they've got a stable of quote unquote people looking after their interests. And that's really where I put the fault is that I don't think that that their people are necessarily doing their jobs to the extent that they should be, and that they're no doubt, you know, making their own marvelous paychecks that maybe aren't being earned to the full extent of how they should be. Let's move on. We've been talking about some fairly fluffy issues to some things less fluffy and more in keeping with Natalie's privacy law background. Let's talk about some interesting privacy developments. Wow, where do we start? A lot going on this week in particular. Let's start with dots, shall we? Dots left behind on paper by printers. This, of course, from our perspective at This Week in Law, for me, was the most fascinating part of this whole reality winner situation. Of course, it's no doubt fascinating that the leak happened itself and the contents of what the leak may reveal about the extent of Russian involvement in U.S. elections and the extent of their efforts and the success of those efforts. That might be more the province of Steve Gibson to delve into over on Security Now. I think the dots are really, really interesting. The fact that it's, you know, widely speculated that Reality Winner was apprehended when The Intercept, the Glenn Greenwald's journalistic organization that he founded in order to help people leak information, and sadly, you know, to help them feel good that they could do so and not have their identities revealed, that was not the case here. We actually don't know for sure because the NSA isn't saying how they put together and found that Reality Winter, had done, by the way, everyone's remarking on her name and I'm just kind of taking it in stride, you know, Reality Winter, of course that's her name. Anyway, that the printed pages that she removed in order to do the leak had this steganography involved where you could actually identify the model of the printer and the make of it and possibly even more information, you know, when the item was printed, et cetera. And the broad speculation is that that's how they pinned down, okay, here's who printed things to that printer. Here are people who had any business printing that item to that printer in connection with their work. And here's Reality Winner who printed it and wasn't working on the subject matter of that. So, I mean, that's sort of the way that people have connected the dots, no pun intended. But this whole question of you know, the steganography and the color laser printer scenario is something that EFF has been tracking since 2005 and has various tools on its site, which will tell you more about this and tell you what printers they know put these kinds of patterns there if you're anxious to use one that does not. Or if you're anxious to know, you know, whether your work printer does, you can go and figure that out. I just think it's a super fascinating issue that 12 years later seems to have come home to roost. And it's not one, you know, with all the work the EFF does, it's not one that I think gets paid incredibly close attention to until something like this happens. When you were interning there, Natalie, were you working on yellow dots on printer pages at all?
I was not. This was not something that came across my desk. It's certainly interesting. And, you know, from an employer's perspective or, you know, someone who's working in-house, this definitely, you know, raises some employee privacy flags. It's a really fascinating issue and one that I think most, you know, generalist corporate lawyers weren't really aware of before this story. So,
right. You know, I think that from a enterprise standpoint, I think that companies would be interested in this for all kinds of reasons, not just in protecting their employees' privacy, but in protecting their trade secrets and things. You know,
of course.
If a doc or even, you know, in a litigation context, in a discovery context, there's all kinds of information that could be gleaned from where something was printed. So I think that was a really fascinating development and good to get it out there more publicly that this is something people should be paying attention to. Mike, what were your thoughts?
Oh, I was fascinated by the story. I didn't even understand or realize that this type of technology was used. So really enlightening. I commend it to everybody. I guess I felt like running off and filing a trademark application for Reality Winner after I read the story.
You wouldn't have been the first, I'm sure. Or for what do your yellow dots say about you? Something like that. Some yellow dots slogan. Matt, as someone who's learning all about, I'm sure, how to put together discovery requests, do you think the legal arena will now find its interrogatories and other pretrial discovery things littered with yellow dot related requests?
I kind of doubt it, mostly because I found the legal world to be somewhat less than technical. Although I agree with Mike, I was shocked that this goes on, and the vastness of it, not just that some printers have this, but most all of them, and even the ones the AFF outlines as not having these dots, they don't know if they have the dots or not. It's amazing.
It is. So watch your dots, people, and watch a Supreme Court case that the Supreme Court has decided to hear. It hasn't heard it yet, but the process that the Supreme Court goes through looks at various cases that people want it to hear, and it selects just a very few of those to go ahead and weigh in on. And one that it has decided it will do that with is called U.S. versus Carpenter. And it ties in really well with the discussion we were having last week about credit card data and Google's new funding choices program, and how we were all just sort of in awe of the fact that it's possible to go out and buy actually personally identifiable information about consumer credit card purchases, and how that might be okay under privacy laws, you know, as opposed to not be okay because there's some sort of fiduciary relationship between you and the party that you're consigning that information to. The Supreme Court case in question involves location information generated by a cell phone. There are a couple of cases that are going to be heard together. Graham versus United States is the other one, along with Carpenter. The first one's from the Sixth Circuit. The second one's from the Fourth Circuit. And in both cases, defendants were apprehended, prosecuted, et cetera, using access, their location access from cell site location records. And in both cases, there was not a warrant. So that is the big question here, is whether you would need a warrant to get that kind of information and then use it against the party here, the defendants in these cases. And the reason it ties in with the Google discussion we were having last week is because this case is going to require the Supreme Court to analyze and possibly rethink something called the third party doctrine, which holds that information that you voluntarily share with someone else, whether that someone else is your bank, such as deposit and withdrawal information, or the phone company, such as the numbers you dial on your phone, that those sorts of things aren't protected by the Fourth Amendment under this third party doctrine, because you can't expect the third party to keep the information secret. So in prior cases, the Jones case, which we've talked about on the show before, justices of the United States Supreme Court have been skeptical of whether this third party doctrine is really what we want in place in today's day and age. Justice Sotomayor said in the Jones case that this doctrine is ill-suited to the digital age, because we live in an era in which people reveal a great deal of information about themselves to third parties in the course of carrying out mundane tasks. We all use cell phones and other devices to stay in touch and communicate and store data, and we rely on GPS mapping technologies to find our way around. So it's impossible to use any of these technologies without sharing data with third parties. But choosing to rely on these technological aids shouldn't mean that we have to relinquish our constitutional rights, is the issue in question here. So keep an eye peeled. We, of course, will keep you posted on the show as the Carpenter case gets briefed and then argued and then decided by the Supreme Court. Mike, are you glad that the Supreme's decided to take this one up?
I am. I think this is going to be really interesting to watch. We spoke before a few shows ago about Neil Gorsuch and some of his Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. Mm-hmm. Now that he's on the court, who knows, he could end up being the swing vote on a case like this. But this obviously has huge, huge implications. That's going to be really fun and interesting to see how it all plays out.
It is. What do you think, Natalie?
I mean, I think this is a massively important privacy issue. And, I'm glad that the Supreme Court has taken it up. And, I'm sure there's going to be forceful advocacy on both sides of the issue. I'm sure EFF and the usual suspects, pro-privacy suspects, will be weighing in heavily on this issue and advocating, on behalf of privacy rights. So this will definitely be an interesting one to watch.
It will. And we'll keep you posted. Matt, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just like privacy. I mean, they were tracking people for months at a time without a warrant. You can argue on a privacy level that, they should be able to track them with a warrant or without a warrant. And the idea that somehow you giving up your information to your cell phone, which you're not giving up. It's not like classically like I'm sharing my secret with someone else. Like, in order to have a phone, that's just how it works. So, I'm glad that they took it up, and I hope that they make a distinction between actually giving up information and having information tracked about you. That seems clearly different.
It does. All right. Well, we've been into the weeds of protecting your privacy and making sure that government agencies have the proper authority to be tracking your information. But I guess we're going to lighten it up again and look at a trademark story. So, Mike, in addition to running down to the trademark office for any and all reality winner-related trademarks, you'd be late if you were trying to trademark Covfefe.
Yes.
Because folks have already been there, done that, and the items are on the market for your Covfefe clothing and mugs and sweatshirts and accessories, etc. Is there anything the Commander-in-Chief can or should be doing about this term that he coined?
Look, yeah, if I tried to apply, I would be late. Big league, okay? Mm-hmm. I would, in fact, as of this morning, I would be the 29th individual or company that has applied for a trademark to register Covfefe.
I'm surprised so few, actually.
Yeah, well, it had an initial spurt of, it shot up to 20 right away. And then I think through dribs and drabs, they've been coming in over the last week or so. But this is a phenomenon, again, that we've talked about before, how items of pop culture reference and what have you, how people rush off to the trademark office to try to get trademark protection with respect to a particular term. I think by and large, it's a little bit misunderstood by the general consuming public as to how the process works and whether you really have the likelihood of getting a registration at the end of the day. Trademark rights are not what we call in gross rights. They only protect your right to use a particular mark in conjunction with a ongoing a business concern. Either you're providing services or goods under the mark. A lot of these folks filed right after Covfefe came out. And so query whether they really had a bona fide good faith intent to use the mark, or they just thought they'd try to apply for it and see if they could ultimately make some money as a result. So you've got that issue. But then probably the larger issue that's likely going to bar most, if not all, of these applications is that, the trademark office is going to look at these applications. Obviously, we'll be familiar with the fact that Covfefe came from the Trump tweet. And this has been, all over social media, all over the news about what this term is. And it's part of the collective consciousness now and part of the political discourse and dialogue. Trademark office is going to look at these applications and say, look, no one's going to think that this is a source identifier. It's simply part of the public debate, the public conversation, and no one's entitled to trademark that. So my prediction is we won't see any COFEFI registrations unless the Donald, President Trump, he could step in potentially and say, look, I coined the term. I should be entitled to trademark it. He is a trademark master, as you know.
And I could totally see him partnering up with Louis Vuitton with some sort of wonderful image in the background, and then it would just say COFEFI across the bag, right?
I love it. And, maybe the president and Jeff Koons would also team up. I mean, that could be quite a dynamic duo right there.
It could. It could indeed. Any COFEFI thoughts from the rest of the panel, Natalie?
When is COFEFI going to go away? That's my just main question.
Clearly not today. Matt?
I refuse to have COFEFI thoughts.
All right. Good. I'm with you, Matt. Already in COFEFI overload. Okay, well, let's move on then to some issues relating to journalism and or the First Amendment. If you missed it earlier this week, Matt did a segment on our sister show here on the network, Tech News Today. He was on episode 1783, discussing the decision by Harvard University to not admit various admitted students because they had participated in this private Facebook, quote unquote, private Facebook chat. That where they were posting some very bad, offensive memes, sharing them with one another, and presumably thinking that they were only sharing them with one another. But the university caught wind of it and rescinded their offers to attend Harvard. So lots of speculation about, how that works. And how it might work in a context where you did not have a private university like Harvard, but a public one, like, say, the universities of California here in my own state. Are people being punished for their speech and or thought crimes here? Yes, it was very bad stuff, and universities should definitely have some control over the ethics and judgment of people who are going to attend that university, and certainly have that kind of control once they're there, taking classes and paying reg fees. But this is a bit of a gray area, whether you should be able to bounce somebody's admission based on this kind of activity, which they, again, whether it was through bad advice or just bad judgment, they thought was private, but was not. Are any technologies, I guess, truly private in today's day and age? Matt, do you think that students could have this kind of conversation, say, on Signal, and have a better argument that, hey, this shouldn't count against us because we never intended anyone but this small group of people to see these offensive things we were sharing?
Yeah, certainly. And you mentioned it earlier, but if it was in the public school context, this would be just generally a different conversation. We would be running through the analysis of whether it was likely to reach the school or whether it was intended to reach the school. And so I think no court has actually said this, but there is language that suggests it, that the more the technology itself is encrypted or something like Signal would be at the far end of this, the more you have the thought that it's going to be private. I think that makes sense. I think in the same sense that if you had an actual conversation and didn't think you were being recorded, you would have the same sort of privacy rights. So that's where I think that the law would come out. It hasn't dealt specifically with that yet.
Right. It seems like a problematic issue. You know, I think here, you know, Harvard being a private university, and the reason we keep making that distinction is because the First Amendment does not get triggered until it's the government impairing your right of free speech and association. So with Harvard, you know, not presumably having any sort of public funding, they're not in that analysis.
Harvard gets lots of public funding. They just don't get direct public funding. So they get it through grants. They get it through, their students are eligible for FAFSA. But there's a line there that whether it's a public university is not the amount of funding. I think that Hillsdale University in Michigan is probably one of the few schools that don't get public funding. Mm-hmm. But it's the same thing with out in Washington when they were bringing the lawsuit against the Trump travel ban. They had sovereign immunity. They had, you know, they were part of the state. They were a function of the state, and therefore they had additional burdens and additional rights.
Right. Mike, do you think that having your Harvard education taken away from you in this kind of context is enough to trigger one of these people to challenge this and maybe bring a lawsuit?
You know what, Denise? I think I'm going to take a pass on that question, if you don't mind.
Oh, not at all. How about you, Natalie?
This raises kind of an interesting strategy question. If you are one of these students who had been, had their rescinded or their offer to attend school rescinded, would you really want to put your name, and kind of admit to the fact that you were doing this just by virtue of filing the lawsuit? I'm not sure any of these students or their parents are really going to take that approach.
Right. I don't know. I think it's
if they're minors, I mean, there might be an argument that they could file suit anonymously, and proceed maybe anonymously. But I would be surprised to see this happen. But you never know. So
right. Again, you certainly wouldn't want to publicly and in any sort of more lengthy way associate yourself with the kind of activity that the students were engaged in here. As a parent, who for good or ill, sees that first of all, minors, as you point out, their judgment is an evolving process. And secondly, that what they're, sharing with each other, our society, I think, has to think about, what the ramifications are going to be of sharing offensive stuff in an era where, if you tune in Family Guy often enough and you don't come away offended, then you're a pretty jaded person right there. So I just think that this is a dicey area to get into, and certainly, as Matt points out, if we were talking about a public university and one that's under the kinds of obligations that come along with being a public university, we'd be having a different discussion here. What else along these lines? Oh, interesting sort of thought experiment that was written up both at Wired and Danny Sullivan's Quora page is to think about from a First Amendment standpoint, what is the impact of President Trump blocking people from following his Twitter feed, which I guess he does on a regular basis, and what both Wired and Danny Sullivan have written about in depth here is whether that constitutes a restriction of speech and association by the government in this case, the President of the United States and his various communications channels that prevent people from participating in the forum that results when the president tweets. And that would be the back and forth of people saying, we agree, we disagree, and, being combative or otherwise with one another and with the president concerning his views. And I think that there's a pretty good argument to be made here that this does implicate the First Amendment. And I will be interested to see if someone decides to take that one further. What do you think, Matt?
I think you have to think about the public forum in a very limited vertical to reach that conclusion, as in not just Twitter and not just the ability to tweet at Donald Trump or to tweet about Donald Trump, but the ability to tweet in response to his tweets. It would be a public forum. Now, I think he's ridiculous for doing all of this, but I think that would have to be a really, really tightly wound argument to make that a public forum. It seems, it seems like it would be it would be an interesting area to take up, but I don't think that the court would find that.
Well, and I wonder if there are some unintended and potentially negative consequences that could come of raising that challenge, because if the discussion around the president's tweets on Twitter is considered a public forum, then is everything on Twitter a public forum? And does Twitter not have the ability to have its own guidelines and standards as to what it's going to permit and not permit? I think you could make the argument that there's a distinction, that you could have certain aspects of a social media platform be a public forum and others not be one. What do you think, Natalie?
It'll be really interesting to see how this issue shakes out. I think there probably is a distinction to be made here by virtue of the fact that, the president is the highest, official in the land. And, this is a place where national, dialogue and criticism has taken place. So I don't think the argument is without merit, that this is a public forum of some sort. So it will definitely be interesting to see whether he keeps up with the blocking and with trying to control who can and can't follow him in light of this criticism.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see. From a practical standpoint, I don't really see why he would bother to block. I mean, it just sort of seems petty that they're, obviously Twitter is full of both a whole spectrum of commentary about our current political situation. It's not really going to make anyone's Twitter experience any more or less pleasant by simply blocking a few followers or previous followers of the president. Mike, any thoughts?
Yeah, when I first saw the story, I thought, oh, come on, this is not a public forum. As I recall, a public forum is streets, sidewalks, parks, places where people traditionally congregate on public lands to talk about things and what have you. But then it struck me as I thought about it a little bit more, there is the concept of a limited public forum. And Matt's probably much closer to this than the rest of us. But Matt, I recall from my law school days the concept of a shopping mall being a limited public forum because it was opened up for discussion and dialogue or something like that. And so maybe this isn't a public forum, but maybe it's more akin to a limited public forum. Could that be the case?
That could be the case. I guess I think about it as in, like, if it's only one vertical within Twitter and not even the only vertical to reach Donald Trump, maybe the best analogy is it is an escalator in a mall, a public forum. It's an even more limited area. I haven't done enough to make that analogy, enough research to make that analogy, but that's just my first impression.
Yeah.
Got it. Yeah, it will be interesting to see, if he continues blocking. I assume he will.
But yeah, and I guess you could make the argument that, Trump's just saying, hey, look, I'm not stopping him from doing anything or speaking his mind. I just don't want to listen to it, right? I want to block him so I don't have to deal with it or see it.
Right.
More akin to putting somebody on mute. He's still able to get his message out in other parts of the mall, to carry on the analogy a little bit further. But I just don't want to listen to him in my space. I don't know. It's interesting, though, for sure.
Right. But it denies the blocked people the ability to see the president's tweets and to participate in those discussions around them.
I want to be blocked from seeing the president's tweets. Put me on that list.
That's our second passphrase for the show. I want to be blocked. If you want more information about listening to the show for continuing legal or other educational credit, head on over to wiki.twit.tv, find our This Week in Law page there. And for lawyers, we have a whole 50-state breakdown on how you might go about submitting to get credit in your jurisdiction. We're going to come back and have one more story and then our concluding material. But before we do that, we need to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Betterment, the largest independent online financial advisor. Betterment is designed to help improve customers' long-term returns and lower taxes for retirement planning, building wealth, and other financial goals. Betterment takes advanced investment strategies and uses technology to deliver them to more than 250,000 customers. Based on the information you share, Betterment will make tailored recommendations on decisions like how much to invest, how much to risk in your portfolio, and the type of investment account you should have. On average, Betterment's tax-coordinated portfolio can increase portfolio value by an estimated 15% over 30 years. Betterment gives you a clear view of your net worth when you sync your outside accounts, such as bank accounts and other investments. Another reason to choose Betterment: low, transparent advisory fees compared to traditional services. Only 0.25% on assets under management, with the option to upgrade to 2.4% or 0.5% for access to a CFP or licensed financial expert. Betterment cares about keeping your money and data secure, which is why they have advanced data encryption and login protection. If you want to talk to someone about your specific financial situation, you can access their team of licensed financial experts. Investing involves risk. For a limited time, you can get up to 6 months managed for free. For more information, visit betterment.com/twill. That's betterment.com/twill. Betterment, rethink what your money can do. All right, one last story for you, this one involving robots. This is a really hysterical thing discovered by Rob Reed, who is the founder of Listen.com, creator of the Rhapsody Music Service. He's a tech investor and a science fiction writer. He was speaking at a tech conference in New York, and somebody had pulled up his bio on the conference site and was really admiring his bio and telling him how bold and funny he thought it was. And Rob had to do a double take and go, wait a minute, you know, there's nothing that bold or funny about my biographical information. And then he realized, gee, I think for that particular conference, all I sent in was a photo and I didn't even send them any biographical information. So let's see how exactly they've got a bio on me. Well, it turned out they had a bio on him because there was a website that generates bios on various people, mostly celebrities, and it is called Article Bio. And the way that those bios seem to be generated is with a really inadequate and sort of hysterical AI. So the bio, it turns out, looks like a combination of a joke and a bad translation from another language, but turns out to be kind of delightful overall, with quotes like, he was born in the year 1966 on 2nd of October, which makes him 48 years old at this moment. At this age, he has already established himself as a very successful entrepreneur and a great author. He was born in a place called New York City, which lies in New York of United States of America. And this makes his nationality American and ethnicity white. And goes on with just further hysterical summaries of the details details of Rob Reed's life. My first response was, do us, please, article bio. I so want the bot that writes up my ridiculous bio in this way. And my second reaction was, we've already been talking about name, image, and likeness misappropriation in this show. And it strikes me as if anyone were upset that these fake bios were out there written by an AI or not, they could probably decide to take issue with what Article Bio is doing. Presumably, they are ad-supported and a commercial enterprise. And then finally, this sort of existential notion of, well, gee, who are you going to sue if you decide to sue? Because really, can you sue a bot for what the bot has cobbled together and thought was a good bio? I think the answer to that question is you would sue whoever implemented the bot. But it's just sort of a fun thing to think about. What do you think? Once your wallet is firmly in place and armed with your RFID tags, Matt, I think you need one of these bios to put forth your image to the world. What say you?
I think that's just generally how I describe myself. So I think it's very accurate. I liked how he took this and kind of commented. I thought it was just an enjoyable article. And it kind of shows the limits of, like, we get excited about technology and what it can do. But double checking is generally a good thing to do.
Definitely, yes. It could take away from this, if you're ever going to speak somewhere, make sure you know what bio they're using. Natalie, do you follow that practice?
Having robots write my biographies?
No. Double-checking on what biography the conference that you're speaking at may be using.
I mean, I would actually kind of be open to it, because I think writing about yourself is one of the hardest things that you can do. So maybe I will employ artificial intelligence to write about me.
Yeah, no, I think that this thing just sounds delightful. Here's another quote. We've been talking about Harvard. He went to the very popular university called Harvard University for his MBA degree. He has been a superstar with his work. You know, you would never be this sort of aggressively generous with yourself writing your own bio. One of his books was named as Architects of the Web, created stir in the market, and it was outstanding. The book was focused solely on the Silicon Valley and was very well crafted and written by this genius. We all need the AI bot to write our bios. All right. On that note, I think we're about ready for our animal selfie of the week. In addition to Covfefe on a Louis Vuitton bag, what I really, really want are Topher Brophy's animal selfies on my Louis Vuitton or other high-end leather goods handbag. Topher Brophy has been taking photographs of himself and his dog Rosenberg and displaying them on his site. The remarkable thing, in addition to the staging that they do, is the striking resemblance between Topher and Rosenberg, and the fact that they play up that resemblance with great aplomb. So they do magic outfits and various scenarios where the two of them are posed together. It's been quite the Instagram sensation. And it's quite a nice story, too, reading a bit about Topher Brophy and how he got his dog Rosenberg. He adopted the dog after he had suffered an injury. And it seems like Topher has really added to his life experience and helped Topher recover and create these delightful images to boot. So the entire collection of Topher Brophy selfies with Rosenberg are our animal selfie of the week. And I think, you know, the perfect partnership right after whatever other brands Louis Vuitton is talking to, au courant of the moment. Topher Brophy on a bag is what I'm waiting for before I drop that kind of money. Natalie, do you agree and approve?
I think this is what you call living your best life, is Topher yes. Brophy is what he's doing. So
absolutely.
Wholeheartedly endorse. Yes.
Yes. Our tip of the week is you might want to think twice about criticizing red light traffic cameras or other government infrastructures in the state of Oregon, because they actually have a law against that and will fine you $500 perhaps if you do. What happened to Mats Jarlström, Matt?
So Mats was an engineer from another country, and he criticized – he's not an engineer licensed in the state of Oregon, and he criticized – the red light traffic ticketing systems, because his wife had gotten a ticket. She was actually going through, straight through. But they fined him $500 for criticizing using math. And the state of Oregon has done this for activists and other individuals who have criticized using engineering. It's just a terrible, terrible policy. So I work at the Institute for Justice this summer, and this is one of the more atrocious cases that they are litigating.
Well, that's good that they are taking this on. Yes, in addition to Topher Brophy on my bag, I want some of Mats Jarlström's math. I think so. On one side we've got Topher, on the other side we've got some of the formulas, and I will be all set. And a great fundraiser perhaps for his litigation. You might want to pass that along, Matt.
Yes, yes.
Yes. Our resources of the week are twofold. Number one, I want to promote our former intern and now practicing attorney friend of the show, Franklin Graves' show, which is for people going to law school, all about going to law school, being in law school, and coming out of law school and enjoying your life afterwards. Natalie was just recently on the show. So if you would like to catch Natalie Nickel and Matt Franklin, definitely head on over and find that episode. How did your interview with Franklin go, Natalie?
Oh, I really enjoyed it. He's great. And we had a wonderful chat about what it's like to go pretty much straight in-house out of law school. So it's something I'm passionate about, is being an in-house lawyer and, you know, getting young attorneys interested in that career path. So it was a very enjoyable conversation.
Right. And it's, by the way, Franklin's podcast is called Law School Strategy. It's available on YouTube. And that is something that people don't necessarily think about doing. You might have it in your mind that you need to go out and practice with a firm or some other way before you go in-house out of law school. But that wasn't your experience, right, Natalie?
No. So I pretty much graduated and went straight in-house. My first big role was with a crowdfunding startup called Tilt. I was their in-house kind of privacy counsel on a contract basis. And then I came down to Orange County to join DITA. And, being in-house is really fun and challenging. I love, all of the different issues that I get to work on. And I think it's something that more and more law students and more, companies are open to doing in this changing legal economy.
Absolutely. We have one more resource of the week for you. Again, getting back to the great things that EFF does that you may not have come across yet, because there's so many great things that they do. Something you should check out is called Panopticlick. And it's a little test app that they have that will connect only anonymous data from your browser, and it will tell you how well your browser and its add-ons protect you against online tracking techniques. They'll also see with this test if your system is uniquely configured and thus identifiable, even if you are using privacy protective software. So this has to do with digital browser fingerprinting, which the EFF describes as a powerful method of tracking users around the internet, and says, sadly, there are some defensive measures that can be taken with existing browsers, but none of them are ideal. In practice, the most realistic protection is using Tor, which has put a lot of effort into reducing browser fingerprint ability. So you may find that you're doing everything right, like using EFF's Privacy Badger extension, and you're still going to find that Panopticlick can identify your browser and that you can be tracked that way. So there's something you can lose sleep over or else use Tor. but we liked Panopticlick and thought that perhaps maybe you might not have seen it. So wanted to highlight that for you. And with that, we're going to go ahead and get out of here. This has been a really fun show. Really enjoyed talking with you, Natalie. And you and I are neighbors. We should get together offline sometime and say hi as well.
That would be great. I'm right down the 73 in Aliso Viejo.
Absolutely. Yes. Thank you so much for joining us. And let us know before we get out of here if there's anything else you want to point people toward, anything you want them to be aware of, anything you're going to be speaking at, or anything you've written, or anything else at all.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, I do just want to promote the Internet Law and Policy Foundry. I'm a member of their founding class of fellows. We just welcomed a new outstanding class of law students, young attorneys, and government professionals who are working on internet law, technology policy, and intellectual property issues. So be sure to support us. We have an excellent resource for anyone who's looking for a job in this space. So we have a job board that's updated regularly. And this is a great way, to get to know other young professionals who are in this field. So it's something I very much enjoy being a part of.
That's great. Thank you so much for reminding us about the Internet Law and Policy Foundry. Definitely a great resource out there, whether you're practicing in this area or just interested in the issues that we cover on the show. Matt, great to see you again. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you. I get to spend my weekend in Michigan. We got a wedding this weekend, which I get to be the officiant for.
Oh, have fun.
I don't think I'm qualified at all, but no one else seems to care.
Did you go through some sort of online certification process for this, or are you just winging
yes.
it?
Yes. I'm not sure which religion I am part of. Please do not tell Notre Dame. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. I think that there will only be two priests at the wedding, which will make it even better. It'll be fun, and it's always good to go home.
Very good. Have a wonderful time. We'll see you next week. Mike, are you back with us?
I am.
Yay. I think Mike dropped out for a bit, but I'm glad you came back to say goodbye.
Yes, absolutely. Sorry, I've had some connectivity issues today, but it was great to be with all of you today. And Natalie, thank you for coming and sharing your expertise and insight. That was a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
All right, folks, we're so glad that you've all been able to join us today. We hope that you've been able to join us live. We do record the show live on Fridays at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. It's fun. If you can join us live, you can join us in IRC, play along as we do the show. But don't worry about it. If you can't do that, the entire archive of our shows is available at twit.tv/twill. You can always go back and catch the show on your own time, on your own device, however you would like. There are all kinds of instructions and ideas about how you might do that if you do head on over to twit.tv/twill. And we love, love, love it when you get in touch with us between the shows. IRC is definitely not the only way to reach us. You can reach us by email. Mike is mike@twit.tv. Matt is mattc@twit.tv. I'm denise@twit.tv. So shoot us an email or find us on Twitter or on Facebook. All great places to let us know what's on your mind, any thoughts that were triggered in your mind by what we discussed today or on any other show, any guests that you think we should look into having on the show, all of the above. Just, and keep those movie and book recommendations coming as well. Those are always fun. Anything else that you think we'd be interested in, we love hearing from you. Please do get in touch and let us know. I promise we're not going to block you. All right. We'll see you next week. On This Week in Law. Take care.